Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 11, delivered on September 29, 2015. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Today, bonds. You might have noticed as this course is going along that I have put somewhat more emphasis on debt instruments than I have on equity, at least so far. Now, we'll get more into common stock and preferred stock and all of that as the course goes along, but I've kind of keyed on the debt instruments that are out there, talking about all the different bills, notes, bonds, talking about government and corporate debt, consumer debt, amortization tables, residual claim versus prior claim and all of that. Focusing on the bonds, there's a good reason for that. You have there are a lot of different ways you can divide up the markets, primary market versus secondary market, capital market versus money market. But one important division is the bond market versus the stock market. Now, most of what people think about when they hear about the financial markets, they think about those ticker symbols streaming across and the price of a share of Google or the price of a share of Sears, something like that. But in fact, the bond market is 10 times the size of the equity market. 10 times the size of the equity market. Hence why I spend so much time bleating about that market. It is enormous compared to the size of the stock market that everyone talks so much about. Well, stocks went down today, stocks went up today, stocks farted today. And yet, this 800-pound behemoth out there just sits there, yep, we're 10 times the size, no one talks about us. Well, here's the thing is, bonds, one reason the media focuses so much on stock markets instead of bond markets is because stock markets are sexy. They are alluring. They're risky and all that kind of stuff. You can talk about, well, stocks went up today because of the president of the corporation was caught having an Ashley Madison account or something like that. But what can you say about bonds? Well, bonds sort of sat there on their ass today again. Yep. That's a media focus on the dramatic, on the dynamic, and focusing on these little things and magnifying them out of proportion to their significance to the world. In other words, what I'm telling you is that, one, companies are much more likely to issue debt instruments of one kind or another than they are equity instruments. In other words, if I want to raise money, you would be more likely to see a company raise money by borrowing some than by issuing stock. One reason for that is that when you issue stock, stock is forever. You are married to that stockholder. But when you issue a bond, it's just basically like that one night stand you had last week. Don't tell my girlfriend that. No, I wouldn't. She's going to be so hurt when I tell her. But you see, stock is kind of like once you put that stock out there, it doesn't matter. So you might buy it and then trade it to him. But one way or the other, it's out there somewhere. And you don't know where it's going to go, and those stockholders can have an enormous influence over you, especially when you issue stock. The great desire is to be picked up by the hedge funds and the long-term investment houses and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's great, but then for the rest of eternity, you're their bitch. You do what they tell you. And I'll tell you right now, there are a lot of companies that don't issue stock because they don't want those suits on Wall Street telling them what to do, which is exactly what will happen. I know very personally stories of large companies. The fund managers, well, we're going to buy a lot of your stock, but what we want to do is have you show us your commitment. So we would like to have you announce a layoff of 5,000 employees. And if you do that, we will buy your stock and the price will go boom like that up in the air. So in other words, those people that are the human capital of your corporation become the bargaining chips of the Wall Street boys. That's how it works out there. Every year, those companies, the Fortune 500, S&P, they trot to Wall Street with their charts and they stand there and they present them to those Wall Street boys, hoping that those Wall Street boys will buy that stock and push the price up. That's part of what Carl Icahn is talking about in his article that I want you to read, is that this is the reality of the equity markets. The bond markets, you're under the control of the bondholders through the covenants of the bond agreement. And the trustee is going to make sure that you behave. In some ways, that's very bad because it frustrates risk taking, it frustrates some aspects of development, frustrates the shareholders with respect to dividend policy, etc. But at the same time, it's also a tempering force on you. It's like the trustee is like that guiding force that keeps you from going, convincing yourself that the stupid is actually a good idea. One way or the other, though, bond markets are much larger than stock markets, but it's those stock markets that get us all kinds of excited. Bonds are boring. Let me make sure you understand. Bonds don't want to go way up and way down in price violently. That volatility that those traders love, up and down, bonds don't do that because bonds are safer than stock, all other things being equal. Bonds are safer than stock. Now, can you tell me why that would be? Why are bonds safer than stock? You got an idea? Well, there is one thing. There's a certainty in the structure of the agreement. That's a good point. I grant you that. You should write that one down, that structuring of the agreement. Stock is almost more like a Wild West kind of thing. But the bond covenants are like, you know what's going to happen. There is a known set of payments over a known period of time at a known interest rate. Much more important than that, though, is that the bondholders have the prior claim on the cash flows of the corporation. They get their money, and if there's anything left, the shareholders can have the claim to that through dividends or through reinvestment in capital, hopefully capital gains. You see, the bondholders, and if the company goes tap city, the bondholders get theirs, the stockholders get diddly squat. They get nothing. If the company goes belly up, the stockholders are out. They're out only their investment, of course, but they're still out. That's the end of it for them. But the bondholders, they'll just liquidate the corporation. As I've told you before, the bondholders will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mama wear furry costumes that please them. They can do whatever they want to you once that company dies. Okay? So in a sense, you think about a corporation or even the entire corporate world. Woman, chocolate mousse. Okay? Think about a layer of fluffy dark chocolate. Then a layer of white chocolate. Then a layer of milk chocolate. Smooth, rich, creamy. But on top of that, you will sprinkle raspberries or some other kind of kicky, slightly tart, sour fruit. I don't know where the hell this is going, but I'm working. Give me a break here. Okay, that mousse, in all of its different layers, in all the different bonds, notes, and bills, that is the substrate of the dessert. the base of the corporate. Will you let me get it out of it, please? And then the raspberries on top. I'm working here. The raspberries on top are that equity, that frisky kicker that makes the company sexy. And so if I come up to you, madam, you're moose.
Okay.
And you look at it and you see only those layers of chocolate, you're going to say, oh man, you're boring. But if I come up to you, hey, you know, maybe dressed like Bruce Springsteen, gotta stay hungry, and you got that raspberry on top, there's more adventure, more danger, more mystery. In fact, are those raspberries sour? Are they sweet? Hell with it. But honestly, the metaphor is stupid, but it's actually kind of the idea is that no matter how risky you want to think you are, your risk-taking behaviors are actually sitting as a thin layer on top of much more standard traditional behaviors. We know that in marketing, especially to younger people, we market to their wild and crazy, their extreme, their radical, I'm one of a kind. But we know damn well that underneath that they are actually in many ways more conservative, more traditional than older people are. And so we play to their sense of what they are, wild and crazy, but we actually are serving them stuff that is just the same stuff we served to their grandparents and their great-grandparents years and years ago in our marketing campaigns. We don't want to really make something radical and wild because most people would run away from it, even people who think they're radical and wild. And as I've said before, I do want to bring up a couple of different other ways that we divide up markets. I mentioned that there's the money market versus the capital market. That's just a fancy way of saying money that's needed for short periods of time, less than a year, versus the market where money for longer periods of time exists. So if I'm a corporation and I need money for 30 days, that would be, I would be issuing debt in the money market. Now here's a classic instrument. There's a famous instrument that's actually very, very big market for it. In the very short-term money market, 30-day paper, it's called commercial paper. Commercial paper. It's issued by very large credit-worthy corporations. And it's 30 days, and there is a clientele of investors who love this stuff. They just buy it, in other words, lend the company money for 30 days, and then in 30 days, the company retires the paper, and the investor gets his money back with a little bit of interest. It's a big, big market. It's used by corporations that are very large, very creditworthy. The paper is considered quite safe. Interestingly enough, though, there have been a couple of burns in this market over the years where large creditworthy corporations issued a ton of commercial paper only to go bankrupt within a couple of weeks. The most famous example would be Enron. Those cats who were running that show, they were some of the scumbags of the universe. They were just getting money for the corporation, then moving it to their own accounts in the islands. They issued a ton of commercial paper in the couple of weeks before the company collapsed. And all they were doing was just getting that money and then just shuttling it into their accounts in the islands. So that kind of damaged the commercial paper market, and so the risk premium went up because the default premium went up. So the paper was selling for some years, a few years after that, at a little bit higher interest rates, but it's still low interest rate, very quick money. And this is for companies that just need cash for cash management purposes for a short period of time. All right, we're going to get this huge check in 3 weeks, but we need money like $12 million right now to pay our bills or to do some project. projects. It's just got to be a go right now. So they'd issued commercial paper, and then they'd have their money come in, and they will pay off the commercial paper. That's a money market. Capital market would be where you're borrowing money for 5 years, 10 years, 20, 30, 50, 100, 200 years. That would be the capital market. And I want to get back to this in a minute, but let me break down one other one. The primary versus the secondary market. Primary versus secondary market. The primary market is the market that you would probably never personally invest in. Pretty sure I can say that with certainty. It's the market where the companies actually issue their instruments, their securities. An IPO, the company would issue its stock. It was going to raise money through an offering of common stock. That would be a primary market transaction. The company issues the stock, and the money that is used to buy the stock goes to the company, minus the brokering fees. And the investment bank will take its share of it. But in other words, the selling of the stock is by the company, and the proceeds, net of fees and brokers, commissions, and all that kind of stuff, goes to the company. The secondary market is the one that you see, that's on the ticker symbols that run across those financial screens and all that kind of stuff. That's the secondary market, where investors are trading stock or bonds or whatever it is among themselves. You'll have someone selling 1,000 shares of Apple and someone's buying those 1,000 shares of Apple. That's a secondary market transaction. It has nothing to do with the company on the surface. However, companies don't like to have their stock price go down. For several reasons. So the company will try to support the stock price in the secondary market by pushing out press releases. Hell, that was what I did for a lot of these sleazy companies I worked for. Press release every week to boost the price of the stock so the insiders could unload some of their stock and buy another house or another boat. But on a more legitimate level, companies want to keep their stock price up, because then if they have to sell more stock in the primary market, it'll sell at a higher price. And so they won't have to sell as much to raise the same amount of money. So companies do want to pay attention to that secondary market price, but that is largely formed by just buying and selling. I had a client, it was a strange little, it was almost like a jaw dropper. It was in the mid-90s. I was connected through another player to this company. It was actually based out of Ontario, but it was its business offices were in the United States. The owners had bought a public company that was dead. And that was something that I did. They're called public shells. They had bought it, and they wanted to bring it back to life. Well, one of the things that they were obviously wanting to do was to have the stock come back to life so that they could, the stock that they had given themselves to do the reorg, they could actually go out and sell it and make a fortune for themselves, they thought. Well, one way or the other, they needed a trading symbol. Their trading symbol was gone. I mean, a lot of times a trading symbol is still there, kind of in the what we call the pink sheet. This thing had its trading symbol was just vanished. So I had to go full bore with a 15C211. It's a form you file with the NASD. You give them audited financials, the whole story of what's going on, and if you qualify, they'll qualify it and they'll give you a trading symbol. I went through all that process, and I finally got him a trading symbol. It took several weeks of back and forth with the NASD, but I got him a trading symbol. Oh, I was just excited. I faxed them. Yeah, back in those days, we faxed. Email wasn't for everybody back then. But I faxed them, trading symbol up. Trading symbol is this. I was really excited. A couple of hours later, the president of this company called me. He said, well, how do we get the money? I said, I don't understand. He said, well, I'm seeing there's trading going on. Do you have our bank account so that they know where to send the money? I said, dude, this is secondary market. You don't get that money. Oh, he was just furious. He called me a scammer. He threatened to sue me and all of that. You know, this money is supposed to be ours. It's trading. No, you dumbass. This is secondary market transactions. Now, as the price goes up, that means that eventually you can do a public offering of stock. And if the stock price is high, you'll get some decent money if you issue, let's say, do an IPO for 10 million shares at $5 a share. You've got the money to get this company going. But this money in this trading, this is buyers and sellers out there. Didn't quite get that. Threatened to sue me. Never did. Fortunately, apparently, he talked to a lawyer who called him a dumbass, too. But anyway, money in capital markets, primary and secondary. Now, let me get back to the capital markets here. A lot of what we talk about is the capital markets. Now, and we're going to talk about debt here. The capital market debt. Companies issue different kinds of securities. You'll see a company that will issue commercial paper, that 30-day short stuff. You'll see them issue maybe some notes, five-year notes, bonds. In fact, sometimes when they do an offering of debt securities, it'll be like a mix of different things because of different needs, different period terms. The other question, though, is what's happening on the other side? The buyers of the debt instruments, in other words, the lenders. They are lending money to the corporation by purchasing the debt securities. Okay, so we could talk about the kind of typical investment buyer who would buy, let's say, a five-year note. The company issues $10 million in five-year notes. Okay, that would be a certain type of client that would want the money for a short period of time, a constant stream, but would then want that money back in a relatively short period of time. Sometimes it's just the needs of the lender. The lender wants the money back in 5 years. Sometimes it's based upon the assessment of the lender. Okay, I think within about 5 years, interest rates are going to be higher, so I want that money back so I can buy new debt at higher coupons that would be out there 5 years. Might be that. Then you got your 20-year paper, 30-year paper. Now, therein lies a complication, though. Talking about the clientele for different maturities of bonds. What would motivate a company, an investor, what would motivate an investor to buy 30-year paper? That's long paper. 30 years, there's just going to be this coupon, and then at the end of 30 years, one last interest payment, and then the payoff of the face on it. What kind of a company would an investor would buy that kind of, or make that kind of a loan? Any idea? You got one? Any idea? And once you get the hang of it, it makes all the sense in the world. It's just thinking about the investment clientele for different types. And interestingly, some companies actually, when they borrow money, they are aiming at a specific clientele. Well, we know paper of this type, this maturity, these covenants is really attractive to such and such an investment group. You got any idea, any thought at all on it? What kind of an investor would want 30-year paper?
Not sure.
You? Got any? Well, that's an interesting thing. In other words, someone would invest in a business that they know is going to be around for a long time, so you would have that certainty of cash flow. Certainly, that would be a longer, older company. That's a good point. Here's a thought. Now, I've probably brought this one up before, but I'm going to bring it again. You are going to die someday. I know that sucks. But, you know, thing though is that imagine if you're an insurance company, you've got buttloads of money, you're a life insurance company, you don't want all that money back right away, because most of that money that you invest will be for long haul payouts, people who are going to live 10, 20, 30 more years. So you don't want the money back right away. You want it back over a long period of time because what you are insuring will live for a long time. So the payout, you need to make will happen way down the line. So the money that would come for that payout should come way down the line. So you would see life insurance companies more likely to buy the longer paper. They love it because they don't need the money back right away. The coupons are great because that will sustain operations and maybe the occasional person who twitches off too early. But for the most part, they don't need the money back right away. So you would see that length. But then let's talk about this. This will probably bother you a lot, but you're not going to live 100 more years, probably. Well, you might, but based on what I've heard about your lifestyle, not even close. 100 years. Why would a company issue debt that had a maturity 100 years, 200, 300 years in the future? Why would any company why would any investor, any lender, lend money knowing that the face value was going to come back in 200 years or 100 years? Because you're going to die well before 200 years, unless technologies really get fancy. What would possess a lender to lend money knowing by the covenants that they didn't get their money back for a very long time? Any guess? Want to take a stab?
Like the risks of what the dollar's
going to
do.
That's a way risk. There won't be a dollar in 100 years, son. It would, if it's done denominated in dollars, that would be a very, very risky thing to do. There's a much simpler explanation. In insurance, there is a concept called frequency versus severity. Frequency versus severity. Some liability exposures have a very high frequency, but they're not severe. Okay? But some exposures happen less than once in a lifetime, but they are extremely severe. Did you know that we sit very close to one of the worst fault lines in the United States? It's called the New Madrid fault line. Now, the last time the New Madrid slid was in the early 1800s. I read a wonderful book, and it had in it many letters of the people who survived the earthquakes down in the St. Louis area. They were describing like an apocalypse. It was some of the most apocalyptic literature I had ever read. Smoldering ruins, half-dead people staggering completely in shell shock. And then more of them came, more fires, more destruction. The earthquakes just kept coming, aftershocks, and then major secondary earthquakes as the New Madrid line kept sliding on itself. Literally, as they described it, the Mississippi River ran backwards. What actually happened was the first earthquake was so powerful, it lifted up the water of the Mississippi, threw it north, and then that water came back down south like a tsunami days and days later, adding to the horror of what had happened. And that New Madrid fault has not slid in about 200 years. About time for it to do it. Now we got much larger cities. We've got all these gas lines that cross the continental United States right through here. Are you talking about a big barbecue? I think so. So in other words, there are these kinds of events that would happen so rarely. If you have piles of money, you would not want that money back for extraordinarily long periods of time, because it would be only over long periods of time that the need for that money might arise. How often would a giant skyscraper in New York City come crashing down on itself? How often could that possibly happen? We'd never seen it before. Well, imagine how often would two at the same time come down. I mean, that just never. Of course, that's why they insured only one of the damn buildings, because one going down was so rare, maybe once in 200, 300 years, both coming down at the same time. Nah, never. Oops. Yeah. So you see insurance companies that are long-haul property and casualty insurers will tend to move towards very long-term securities. Now, interestingly enough, and I'll give this as a side note that's going on right now, we've talked with a couple of reinsurers, the heavies that insure the insurers, and they're talking about the concerns they have for gray swans and black swans. Now, gray swans are events that happen once in a lifetime, what I've been talking about. There's a concern that there will be more gray swans over the next, probably starting real soon and over the rest of your lifetimes as climate change bites in harder. The predictions are that there will be more of these gray swans, you know, once in a lifetime things. But what they're really concerned about now are what are called the black swans, the events that have never happened before in history. Tidal waves, hurricanes, tornadic weather, things like that, that we've never seen before, because the models are beginning to point that there is a higher and higher probability as we drop farther and farther into the global climate change that the black swans will start to show up. And so there's something that's interesting about their investment patterns, because as the insurers and the reinsurers start to have their models call more of these gray swans, more of these black swans, you'll see them moving towards the kind of investments that would provide the payoffs that would match those kinds of swans. Interesting how everything is kind of connected in the world. We think about climate change as some political argument. Nah, it's gone way beyond that in the business world, in the rational business world. Now when you get down to the point where they're talking about investments, changing investment patterns based upon the modeling of the swans, that's cool stuff, but it's also kind of ominous too. Okay, here we go. Where the hell was I? Here's the thing about bonds. A bond has all these covenants, has a trustee that watches, makes sure the company obeys all the rules for the sinking funds, for their dividend policy, and for keeping the bondholders' loans safe and secure and all that kind of stuff. So if we were to say, oh, TNJ, and I got to watch because the trading symbol, the whole stream looks a little different these days. 8%, 20, 35. That would be a bond that has, and consider this a primary issue bond. It's a primary issue bond. It's just come out. It'll pay. And let's say that the issue was for $100 million. All that's saying is that an investor is going to get an $8 million check every year for 20 years. In 20 years, one last $8 million check and the payoff. The $100 million will come back. In other words, in corporate and government debt, it's serviced through the life and then it's finished off. That's classic, typical bond stuff. And remember that you do on your calculator, assume a face value of $1,000 unless someone says differently. The book does a few with $100, but it's $1,000 is your typical face value. So in other words, what they'd actually be doing is they'd be issuing 100,000 of these pieces of paper in blocks. They probably have 100,000, but it's the face value of each one would be $1,000. By the way, it will not be $8 million every year. Tradition has it that you pay it in two semi-annual installments, each coupon. So when you key this into the calculator, the N would not be 20, it would be 40. And the payments would not be $8 million, they would be $4 million each. It's just the way it's always done. It's traditional. And also don't forget that the interest rate would be half of an annual rate. So if you're keying it in, you divide by 2 for the market. And if you are finding it, you'd have to multiply it by 2 to bring it back out and report it. I'll show you that in a minute. Don't sweat it. Don't sweat it. But before I get to that one, I've shown you another one several times. They come under different names, and not sure which one the textbook settles on. But essentially, I showed you one of these, like the second day of class. The government will issue a debt instrument that has a 1 year. It's a term of 1 year. Maturity is 1 year out. Has a face value of $1,000. And the price value of it is whatever the market bears. Let's say the price value on it is $970. It goes out at $970. In these, there's no coupon. You make your money through the spread between the purchase and the payoff. So in other words, with these, your interest is not listed as a coupon. It's simply the spread. In this case, you get made $30. And so you can calculate the yield very easily with this thing as $30 over $970, how much you make over how much you invested. And I think that comes out to be, 3.09%. I do hope so. Now, there are different names for these. The one that, the discount, they're called discount paper because essentially you're just buying it at a discount to par. The 1,000 is the par. The face is the par, okay? So they call them discount paper or discount bills because they just sell at a discount to the. Another term for them that the book seems to like, the authors of the book seem to like, they're sometimes called strips. This is a strip. It's stripped of coupons. It just sells at a discount, and you get back $1,000, so you make your money on the spread when you put the clothes on the naked price. Another name for them that's a larger name that includes more instruments, are what are called ZCBs. Zero coupon bonds. These are, in general, risky as hell. I don't think I've ever seen a treasury bill referred to as a ZCB, although technically that's what it is, a zero coupon bill. But ZCBs, zero coupon bonds, work like this. You got a company. It's a startup. It's not going to have positive cash flow for at least a couple of years, probably longer than that. It's going to bleed red all over the place. It's not going to have money to pay off, to pay interest payments, those coupons. So if it issued a traditional bond, it would be the debt holders would have it in bankruptcy court immediately, liquidate the thing. So there was this period of extraordinary growth. It happened, it would have been in your lifetime, well, I don't know, would it? Yeah, right about in your lifetime, a little before till a little after you were born, we had an incredible, an unbelievably good economy. The economy of the 1990s, from about 93 on, just kept growing. It was like the stock market just kept going up smoothly. The unemployment rate kept falling. Now, traditionally, economists talk about a natural unemployment rate, maybe 4.8, 4.3%. The unemployment rate just kept going down and down, down into 3.8, 3.5, 3.3%. And then also, the economy was doing so good, and taxes were the tax structure was extraordinarily stable. This dynamic tension between a Democrat in the White House and Republicans in Congress, no one played with the tax rate, jerking it down, jerking it up. It just kind of stayed stable. That created for a much more stable, predictive environment for investment by companies. And so tax revenues to the government just kept getting better and better. Our budget deficits started disappearing to the point where by the near the end of the 90s, the government wasn't borrowing money anymore. It didn't need it. It was, in fact, starting to pay off that massive national debt that had been piled up for decades before. So literally from the time of Kennedy onward. It almost came down to zero in the later part, in the last year of the Carter administration. But then in the 80s with Reagan and then Bush, it just skyrocketed the deficit. We were starting to pay off the national debt, for God's sake. It was just an unbelievable time. Well, unfortunately, interestingly enough, old school tradition says, well, if an economy does too well for too long, you're going to have inflation. Oh, God, inflation. So the chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time, Alan Greenspan, went before Congress, and he said something that was just jaw-dropping. He said, the stock market has no reason to be going up like it is. He said, this is obviously, quote-unquote, irrational exuberance. He actually used the word irrational to describe the stock market. Now, have you ever been eaten by a shark? Yes, I have. You haven't? Okay. Now, imagine that you are. Now, you're going to think that that shark is being very rude to you, eating you. I mean, it's just going crazy. You're kind of gristly. But is it, you might say, well, that's irrational what that's doing. No, not to it. It's not irrational. It wants to eat you, and it's going to. Okay? So, you understand that Greenspan was saying something that was just, it just is kind of an irrelevant thing. But here's what was really going on. You see, if the government stops borrowing money, one of the instruments the government uses to borrow money is treasury bills. The Federal Reserve uses treasury bills to execute open market operations, its primary tool of monetary policy. If the government is no longer issuing treasury bills, the Federal Reserve's control of the economy vanishes. Gone. So, Alan Greenspan declaring that this was all going to end in horror and inflation and destruction and diarrhea, the Federal Open Market Committee started jacking up the discount rate. One time after another after another. The longest sustained chain of interest rate and discount rate increases in Fed history. He was be damned if he was going to let that dancing man keep dancing. He was going to keep pumping bullets into it until it died. The problem with that was the ZCBs, and I'm going to show you and see if you can catch why this is. Zero coupon bonds are highly interest rate sensitive. They're fragile that way. And so these creatives out on the coasts who had designed these to finance the dot-com revolution, well, once interest rates started going upward and up and up, well, those ZCBs snapped like twigs in a storm, one after the other. That what they called the dot-com boom just collapsed in a heap of rubble. And then the media joined the Fed and the Treasury and saying, this is all the fault of those evil finance masters that were doing these evil instruments, this junk bond stuff. Michael Milken went to prison, a lot of others. Oliver Stone made some great movies about the evils of us finance people and all that kind of stuff. Well, it was because these are highly interest rate sensitive little animals, these ECBs. And like I said, I'll show you, see if you can see what the problem is, why they are dangerous in a highly volatile interest rate environment. Here's how it works. A company won't have the cash flow. It's a new company. It won't have the cash flow for a traditional kind of bond issue. To borrow money, it's not going to have $8 million or $4 million every 6 months. It's just not going to have it for years to sustain that. So the creatives said, let's try it this way. Okay. Let's make, let's say, a 7-year instrument. We simply sell that at a deep discount to the par value. And the lender gets nothing until the end of the life of the instrument. Then it gets $1,000 back. You see why it's called a zero coupon bond, a ZCB? There's no coupon. The investor, who would obviously be taking a very serious risk, they're going to ask for a pretty penny in terms of the price of these is going to be very low to compensate. The investor is going to get the payoff in terms of the spread between the stripped and the clothed. You follow how they work? Now let me show you the formula for finding the yield. It's actually just a twist on that one. It's just an algebraic manipulation. That one's actually just a highly specialized version. Here's how you calculate the yield on one of these animals. And I'll do it for this one so you can see it actually being done. What you're going to do is you're going to take the $1,000 divided by the $600, and you're going to raise it to the 1 over the number of years the thing is out there. And then don't forget to subtract 1. Don't forget to subtract 1 for God's sake. Otherwise, you'll get a 1% interest rate or something like that. Now, these are actually better for a scientific calculator, or at least a scientific facility on a normal calculator than they are. I'm going to push this one out. If you've got a calculator that can do exponents, reciprocal exponents and all that, then I would encourage you to try to follow with me on this. Where's my calculator? Okay, I'm going to put in parentheses, open parenthesis, 1,000 divided by 600, and then I'm going to close the parentheses. Again, open parenthesis, 1,000 divided by 600, close the parentheses. Now, hit the raise to the Y to the X button. And then in parentheses, again, do open parenthesis, 1 divided by 7, close the parenthesis. And then you subtract the 1 and hit equals. And you should come up with 0.07570. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to round that to 2 decimal places, so that'd be a 7.57% yield. That's the yield to maturity. It's called the YTM, the yield to maturity on the animal. You follow how to do it? It's just algebra. Honestly, it's easier to do it this way. I could show you how to do it on the financial calculator. I mean, but at the same time, it's not that hard to do it this way. And like I said, this is just a generalized version of the, I kind of do a little bit of an algebraic trick for these 1-year strips, but for the ZCBs, I just do it that way. Now, you see, the problem was, though, that because essentially, I'm looking around for the right person to ask this. You, son. You obviously have read 50 Shades of Grey, right? Yeah. Okay, now, do you remember the bullwhip?
No.
Dude.
Well, yeah.
Okay. That wasn't CGI. That was the real deal. Okay, now, when you snap a bullwhip, the whole trick with using a bullwhip, and I was taught this down in Texas, the whole trick is not to make the whole bullwhip go. It's to make the end of it go. And the articulation, the longer the bullwhip, the more a small motion with a small hand here creates a thwack out there, okay? So think about something that has no control in the middle, like a bullwhip, so that it's only what happens here that causes stuff out there. So a tiny disturbance here can cause an insane amount of... that hurt, Carl. Don't do that again. Okay. Carl, he's a guy. Never mind. It was a long time ago. Okay. So you see, that's the thing with these long-term instruments that have no sustaining support in the middle with coupons that you're paying along at like sort of like a certainty. They're just what you put here and the whack that happens out there. That's why when the Fed popped the interest rates and kept just jerking them up and up and up, these ECBs just collapsed into a heap. Their prices fell to nothing. The dot-coms just went to hell. The whole nine yards. All because a Fed chairman was pissed off because he would no longer be able to control the U.S. economy through open market operations. So he wanted to stop the growth of the economy, kill off, and that didn't do it. The economy kept going. So in 2002, he joined the bandwagon that we were in a terrible recession. We were in no recession. And we had to cut taxes just on the brink of two giant theater wars. We cut taxes the longest, sustained, deepest tax cuts in U.S. history. And so the government's fell right back into deficits as far as the eye could see. And all those things we've been talking about, all the money we had, free education for college students, space stations, exploration of the planets, it all went to hell. Because we had someone who thought markets are irrational in their exuberance. Okay, that's enough of that one. So now, let's talk about this guy. Here's the problem. First, I'm going to show you the unrealistic version. Now, remember that the face value is $1,000 unless I tell you otherwise. That's called par. Par. Okay, so what's going to happen here is that the company is going to be giving 8% to investors. But have you ever been, there's a restaurant I went to once, it's called Surprise Me. I was so sorry I went there, but it was literally, you went in there, you could order for the menu, but you could also say, surprise me. It was not good at all. It was sort of like the first time I actually went to a real sushi sashimi restaurant. I mean, that was a surprise. Did you know that they serve living things, you know, the shrimp, they had a jumping salad, the shrimp were popping around in it. Well, that was a surprise to me, and it was a surprise to the shrimp, too. He looked at me, ah! Okay, anyway. Here's the thing, is that I'm trying, will you give me a break? For God's sake, I could be a PowerPoint professor. Yeah, there's your damn lecture, click. Go home, goddammit. Okay, anyway. Look, you see, the investors, the company's going to say, here's 8%. Surprise! Well, you might be really happy. Well, I was expecting only 7.5%, so yeah. Okay, so in a case like that, it's a good surprise. So in a case like that, you might be willing to pay more than $1,000 for the bond. In other words, if the interest rate that the investors want is less than the coupon, the bond would sell at a premium to par. At a premium to par. It would sell for a little more than $1,000 because you're making the investors very happy. So investors would buy these, push up the price. But it could be the other way. At that Japanese restaurant, they had something that I asked for the translation, and I was so sorry. It was Manowar. You know, one of those things, the bubble thing, and they grab ships and they drag them down. Oh, that's a squid. Never mind, Manowar. Anyway, but the thing, though, is that it might be the investors wanted 8.6%. And all you're giving them is 8%? Well, they're going to say to you, you suck. And they're going to sell these and drive the price down, and the bond would then sell at less than $1,000. So it would sell at a discount to par. Let's say that investors want a yield on the bond. What they wanted was a yield of 7.6% per year. Now remember, we say everything in years, but bonds work in half years. So when we key these into the calculator, we got to make sure. Seriously? I thought I turned on the projector. Yeah, there it is. Now, just watch. This is the kind of thing, just monkey see, monkey do on how you do this. The first thing that you're going to want to do, how many years is the term of this bond? What's the term of the bond? That's about how many years are remaining. The term of the bond is how many years are remaining. What is the term of this bond, the TNJ bond? That's not complicated, folks. That's 20 years, okay? So how many payments are going to happen? 40. So I'm going to put in a 40 for the... excuse me. Oh, that grand slam was better first time. Okay, and... the interest per year. Now, what we're going to do here is ignore that, and we're going to say we want to take 7.6 and divide it by 2 equals. And we'll put that in as the I over Y. Now, remember, if you're doing this the other way and you're finding the yield to maturity, it's going to spit out half of the right answer. Don't forget to times that by 2. In other words, if you're calculating I over Y, you say compute I over Y, it'll be giving you half of the right answer. And you put in half of the yield on the if you know that part. Now, the present value, we're going to find the price of this bond. So the payments are going to be $8 million a year, but that's going to be $4 million. Actually, you don't even have to do that. Just put it as 8% of the par. Screw that. $40. I'm sorry. Just put in $40. 8% of 1,000. You don't have to go crazy with the big numbers. And the payment, you key that in. That's the payment. Now, here's the thing you have to remember, though. The bond has the end kicker on it. The bond gives you back your 1,000 at the end. So you've got to put in the face value, 1,000. Don't forget to do that, but don't forget to clear that out if you're doing a normal present value problem. I've done it sometimes. Why is my answer so weird? Oh, I forgot to clear out that 1,000 from that bond calculation. Now, let's compute the price of it, the price value. Compute present value. Well, look at that. 104079. 104079. The price would come out to be 104079. Now, if it's a quote, you don't put the dollar sign on. If I wanted to say, if someone said, "What's the quote?" you would put that as 104.08. If you were asked for a quote. Remember I told you about, I don't know, maybe I didn't. I knew this guy, he fancied himself a day trader years ago. He was actually an optometrist. And he bought a bunch of bonds. And he didn't know that he was looking at the quote. When he got the bill from the broker, what the hell? Frank, you dumbass. You thought that was the price? No, that's a quote. Back in the old days, they had so many columns of bonds in these old newspapers that they would put them at a tenth of the price. So you still see this tradition of today, well, what's the quote? So be sure that you're looking. If it's a price, it's a dollar sign. If it's a quote, don't put the dollar sign on or someone will really, really read it wrong. But anyway, there's your quote. Now notice something. The price is above the face. This bond sells at a premium to par. Just like we thought it would. The market says, you give us 7.6%. But This bond gets 8%. It's like you work at Subway, and your name is Jared. Someone very nice comes in and asks for a 6-inch with baked chicken, and you give them a 6-inch with baked chicken and some bacon on it. Well, of course they're going to want to pay you more. Can I give you more? And you, of course, no, ma'am. I work for Subway. I won't ask for more from you. Here's my card. Too soon? Yeah. Now let's look at it the other way. Let's try the real way. The market's not going to tell you the yield. What's probably going to happen is that they are going to give you the quote. You're going to see a ticker. The quote on the bond is 98.42. That's what you'll see. But now, if we know that, we can do the yield to maturity. So here, we're doing it the real way. We're going to see the price running across the ticker screen. So first things first is, do you notice that this bond is selling at a discount to par? Do you see that? That means that the market probably wants more than 8%. Well, let's see. Let's go and reset it. Number of periods, again, the term is 40 years remaining. This time we don't know the I over Y, but we do know that the price is $984.20. Don't forget to put it in as a negative. Don't forget that. PVs are always supposed to be put in as negatives. They come out as negatives. Don't ask me why. Now, the payments are the same as they were, $40, half your payments. And the kicker is the $1,000 at the end. And this time, we're going to get the interest. But don't forget, you put in half year, out comes half year. So we're going to have to times it by two. Compute the yield. My ass, what the hell? Naan? What's naan? Isn't that a bread you get at the curry restaurant? What the hell? Am I supposed to put in 984? 20, present value, compute. It let me put in a positive. Okay, now, you take that 4.08 and you times it by 2. 4.08 times 2. And look at that. The market says it should pay 8.16%. That kind of confirms for you that, yeah, it was selling at a discount to par, so the yield should be above the coupon. That's all I have for you. I thank you.